Hi, and welcome to Thriving with Sarah and Jenny. Please join us as we explore how you can enjoy a happier life and a fulfilling career, things that aren't always that easy in our modern world.
We'll be taking a look to how you can explore well-being both inside and outside the workplace, how to prevent burnout, how to achieve true happiness in work and life, and so much more. So stick around.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's episode of Thriving with Sarah and Jenny. Today, we are absolutely delighted to be hosting a fellow Happy Startup Vision 2020 program graduate and I think just all around inspirational human, Ray Martin. Ray, or the Daily Explorer, I think is how you like to refer to yourself, is an entrepreneur, award-winning business leader, coach, mentor, facilitator, speaker, author, mindfulness teacher, and really, you know, likes to be a torchbearer for human consciousness. You also run marathons and fundraise.
That's right.
I think your mission is absolutely beautiful. It's to help people live authentically, bring more joy and happiness to the world, which is something I think Jenny and I can absolutely get on board with.
And we definitely need it, don't we? We definitely need it.
We are just so happy to have you today.
Thank you.
So that's the true intro, you know, the one that we write and we say. But I think the more interesting part of that story, Ray, is how did you get here?
Yeah, that is an interesting part. If someone had said to me, I don't know, let's say 20 years ago, that this is what would have happened, I would just laugh. I mean, there's no way I could have imagined it, because in 2003, I was a successful CEO running a business in London and married to a woman who was my business partner. And we'd built the company from scratch and it was growing and, you know, working in the field of leadership development and coaching, and everything was just on paper, you know, beautiful and all working. Mm. But I had this growing sense inside myself that I was not on the right path for some reason. It just really bugged me all the time. And I could never talk about it with anyone because I felt so guilty that I was even thinking that way. Because even if I mentioned it to people, they'd say things like, well, you should be grateful for what you've got. Look at you, you've got a great wife, a great life. You've got, you know, you've got everything. It's not right you sort of moan or think this is not good enough or something, you know. So I never really had an outlet for that. Yeah. And I never really understood what it meant, but it progressively got more and more louder and louder. Just kept ignoring it. Until the day that my wife came back from a business meeting and said, I'm leaving you and I'm leaving the company.
Wow.
Then that was the turning point, really. That was the detonator that set the cat amongst the pigeons, mixing metaphors here. And so at that point, I couldn't ignore that sense any longer because it had been going on for quite a long time. Mm. And unfortunately, my father got very ill and he passed away at the same time. And so there was a lot of change going on. And I sort of had to stop and say, what's the meaning of these events? What's going on? Mm. How should I reflect and respond to this? I was broken. I really was lost. I mean, I'm talking about it like I was really clear or something, but at the time I wasn't. I was really desperately unhappy and really lost.
Yeah.
And friends of mine suggested that I took a 6-month sabbatical, which I never had done. And I'd worked since I was 16. I left school at 16, went straight into commerce. And I was thrilled to have done that and just sort of learned everything by doing lots of different things in different businesses. Mm. And when they said take a 6-month sabbatical, I thought, yeah, that's not a bad idea. You know, I should do that. So I minimalized my life and I learned a lot about minimalism in that process and left myself with a bag of clothes and a laptop and thought, right, I'm going to go and backpack around Asia for 6 months because I'd never been a backpacker. I never had a gap year. And I was in my early 40s. I thought, no, I'll have my own gap 6 months.
Yeah.
And I'll sort of get my head clear. I'll sort it all out and I'll come back and start something else. Well, of course, that was the plan. But I think it was John Lennon who said, life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans or something.
Yeah, yes.
It never went according to plan because at 6 months into the journey, I did a Vipassana meditation retreat in a Buddhist monastery in Thailand. And it just totally and utterly changed my thinking about life and what was happening to me and took me to a much deeper place of reflection and insight about life itself and what was going on in my own life in particular.
Wow.
And I wanted to carry on. And then that ignited a sort of sense of curiosity and compassion in me. And I then started a foundation to raise money for an orphanage in Nepal and an elephant sanctuary in Thailand. By chance, I met someone who was a marathon runner, and I said to him, "Do you teach me how to run a marathon?" And he said, "Yeah, okay, I will." That's how I started there. And then the journey just continued and continued. And it was 14 years later that I returned to the UK to finish writing the book that I started writing.
So had you actually started writing your book during your 14 years gap year?
Yeah, I had. And yes. I'll tell you why, because a lot of what I saw writing in the book is talking about a phenomenon which we all know, which is that inner voice that we have, the guidance that comes from our own inner wisdom. And lots of people write about how you tune into that, how you relate to that, how you even amplify it in yourself. And certainly meditation and those kinds of practices helps to amplify it. But my inner voice had been talking to me about that, because on my travels, I would, you know, when you, if you've done traveling yourself, you know, you meet loads of people in places you stay or restaurants you eat in, and they say, "Oh, tell me what made you start this journey?" And I tell them a similar story to the one I'm telling you. And after an hour of conversation, when they were saying goodbye, quite a few of those people said something along the lines of, "Listen, I'm not sure if you're going to, but if you ever write a book about your journey, would you let me know? Because I'd love to read it." And I just used to laugh. I used to literally laugh and say, "No way. I didn't do this to write a book. I'm not even a writer. I said, I'm just doing this for me." But yeah, thanks for saying that. I'll make a note of your email address just in case. And once I got to about 50 people that had said that, you know, after two or three years, I thought, well, maybe I should. And then it got to 100, like a year later, I thought, I better start writing a book. I think the universe is making it pretty clear. It keeps coming back.
You were getting a repeated message.
I love that. I love that. And what a cool way to actually like record those repeated universe, because quite often we don't have like a salient way to do that, but you've actually done that, which is such a neat way to-
It's one of the things I've referred to in the book, what I call confirmation signals, because I was a pilot, trained pilot. So when I was flying airplanes, you have to navigate using instrumentation in the aircraft. And when I learned how to fly, it was pre the days when they had GPS. It didn't exist then. And so you followed these electronic beacons on the ground that had a radio frequency. So if you wanted to fly, say, from London to Brighton, you'd find the nearest beacon located in Brighton, tune the frequency in your cockpit to that beacon, and then a needle in your cockpit would start pointing towards it, and you just fly in the direction of the needle. And so that's how that works. It's really straightforward. The issue is, if you, in by mistake, you put one little digit wrong, and you're now flying direct accurately towards Birmingham or somewhere else that's got a very similar frequency. So you have to get a secondary confirmation signal that you've chosen the right beacon, and that comes via your ears. It's a Morse code signal, and it's unique to that beacon. And if you get the confirmation signal and then you match it to the Morse signal you're expecting, you know you're definitely going in the right direction. And so that's a metaphor for me for life.
Wow.
There's always got to be a confirmation signal when you make these fork in the road decisions. And this was one for me that people kept on saying, "I want you to write a book. I want to read your book."
I want to go forward, but actually I want to take you back again, because I think for people listening, you know, a lot of the work that Jenny and I do and what we speak to is, you know, around in the workplace.
Yeah.
And I'm really taken by you saying that this was this voice in your head you weren't allowed to talk to. I want to know, at that time, before you had your kind of, you know, hammer hitting moments, your forks in the road, your however lightning bolts, however you want to call them, how did that show up? What did it feel like? Sound like? Was it as simple as like, there must be something more, or was it deeper? How did it surface?
Yeah. If I think back to some of the major ones, there was a lot of feeling of anxiety and sort of tightness and sort of cramping and worry generally around those kinds of big decisions.
Yeah.
And fear of how things could go if they didn't work out well and those sorts of things.
And was that in relation to the life you were living, or the idea of leaving the life you were living?
The idea of leaving the life I was living, because certainly I'd built my reputation in being a business leader and running a business and everything related to that, you know. So everyone sort of had any sort of admiration for me, it's because of that. So I thought if I just jettison that totally, then maybe I'll lose all of that as well. You know? But there came a point where the fear of that was less than the potential and the excitement of pursuing what felt energetically like a new path. And so there was a sort of tipping point. I can't remember exactly when it happened.
Yeah.
It happened gradually, really, for me, because I was in such a desperate state. This is an important part of the story. I was in such a desperate state when Charlotte left and my father passed away and everything was crumbling around me. You'll know this, Jenny, because it's an Australian book by Bronnie Ware, The Top Five Yes. Regrets of the Dying.
Yeah.
It's a very famous book. And that book had a massive impact on my thinking at the time, because she wrote very clearly that on their deathbed, everyone says what they most regret. And the top five she wrote in the book, the number one regret was, I wished I'd lived my life true to myself. Mm. And that really, that just hit me like a punch between the eyes. I mean, I thought, wow, I just would so love to know what living life true to myself looks like for me, if it's not this.
Wow.
And so that became my quest.
That became your quest, and that's how you spent the next 14 years working that out, I guess.
I thought it might find an answer sooner, but it didn't turn out that way. Well, actually, it's not true. It's more like the answer to that question is like a jigsaw puzzle. It has several pieces that fit together, because living life true to myself involves work. It involves my home. It involves how I want to show up as a man in the world. It involves relationships with others. It's got several pieces to it, all of which need to have the feeling of me being true to myself in each of those areas of my life, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me quite a long time to piece it all together. But bit by bit, it became clearer and clearer over time. And one thing, for example, that became crystal clear for me was that even though I was very competent as a CEO and I'd received an award to prove it, I wasn't enjoying being in that role. I didn't like it. There were so many parts of that job that I didn't like, especially the legal and financial and accounting parts and the regulatory parts and, you know, the job of administering a business. I really liked the work with the clients, but I was hardly ever doing any of it because I was so tied up with the other stuff.
Mm.
And so I made a decision about 4 or 5 years into the journey that I was going to go freelance and become a freelance coach. And I wasn't ever going to operate a business again or own a business again, because I didn't really enjoy that.
Amazing.
And so that was a major decision. And it was scary because you earn a lot more money being an owner operator of a business than a freelance coach, but by a long shot. But I realized that that wasn't for me. I'm not saying I love money, of course, we all do. But for me, it just wasn't important enough to make that kind of sacrifice.
Mm. It sounds like it wasn't the driver that you thought it was.
Yeah.
Because I think many of us in our society are led to believe that, you know, in order to be successful, we do have to push and push and push and adhere to that driver of success comes from owning a big house and a nice car and going on expensive holidays, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody goes, "Ooh, aren't you wonderful and so successful?"
Yes.
But I think unless you have the opportunity to actually take a bit of a deep dive, which obviously you have had, then we're potentially missing out. So I'm curious as to, obviously, a lot of your work today is helping other people who may be experiencing some of that angst and anxiety that something's not quite right and they can't put their finger on.
Yeah.
So is your work today around supporting those people who know of you through your story to help them?
Well, the book only just came out of 3 or 4 months ago, so it's starting, but it's quite early days, but praise of God, it will be, which is, of course, one of my visions is to be there and be a support for others who are wanting to walk their own true path. You know, that's one of the things that brings me massive amount of joy is seeing someone on their own true path. Yeah, that's an amazing thing to be part of.
Yeah.
I'm working as a leadership coach, and there are many, many elements of what I've understood to be true for everybody who I work with. So I can definitely get a sense of satisfaction from the people I'm currently working with.
Mm.
Well, who, and let's face it, you know, I'm sure you probably got something to say about this yourselves. You know, if you've got happy people in a corporation, then that's actually adding an energetic imprint into the world that's making it better for everybody, you know, so it's kind of worthwhile to do.
Yeah. 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 Absolutely. That's what drives me for sure. That's exactly the goal. So bringing it back to that space, obviously, and not saying like you were so lucky, but saying you were in this really fortunate position at that point in your life when those things happened, then you had the opportunity or the means or bravery, all those things come together, mm-hmm. where you could say, I am putting down my old life. And I'm going to go on this new one. For people who that's not practically possible for whatever, a very, very myriad of reasons.
Yeah.
And that could be, they just feel like it's not, so it's too scary. So there's probably like a couple of answers, but I want to know, like, can people go on this kind of journey, explore it in a micro way? And have you got some suggestions for how they might explore that?
Yeah, the answer is yes. And I stress this in the book. My book is not an advert for kind of long-term travel. I mean, I remember, I never imagined I would be gone for such a long time.
I know. Jenny and I were packing our bags.
Yeah, we wanted to go.
it was never my intention. It just how it played out. But no, what I'd say, what it really comes down to in my view, and other people might challenge this, but in my view, the massive agent for change is a change in how we think, is essentially what it comes down to. I became more aware of what and how I think than I'd ever been aware of in my life before. Now, I happen to have made those discoveries whilst in Asia, whilst traveling. I could have made those discoveries somewhere else. I could have, a couple of years ago, I did a third Vipassana retreat in Hereford in England. And it was a more powerful and profound experience for me there than it had been in the first two I'd done in Asia. But I was already back in England when I did that. So there are resources and facilities around for people in it, wherever they are. Now, that's not to say they're going to do a Vipassana, by the way, but one has to get really curious and engaged with one's own inward system and how one thinks, and do a lot of deep reflection on that, because that's where the insight for change is coming from. Now, the warning is, if you stay in your own environment, you're tending to be surrounded by people who always think the same way, you know, got the same ideas. So there's very little outside stimulation or support for a new way of looking at something. So there is an argument to saying it does work to take yourself out of your normal circumstances, even for short periods, even for a couple of days, just to surround yourself with people who think totally differently. Like if you're an engineer, go and spend a couple of days with some artists or something, you know, it will be an interesting experience because their mindset's totally different.
Love that. I love that.
You've mentioned curiosity several times. And I think that comes across very strongly, that you were able to tap into your own curiosity. So I think the issue is, because so many of us are so busy rushing around doing everything else, that we forget to actually take time out to get more curious and to give ourselves permission, but also put ourselves in a place where we can stay curious and do that little bit of exploration. Do you see curiosity piece as the essential component to lead people to really examine who they are, what their life is all about, and where they want to take next?
Yeah, I do. I've got a couple of things I want to share about this, because it's such an important point for me in my own journey of learning. When you meditate and start to do a lot of work to calm your own mind and see things how they really are, is how the Buddhists describe it, you realize that, you know, you're conditioned by society to judge everything. And I mean this in a literal sense. It's not like I'm not saying that's a bad thing or a good thing. It just is what it is. You are taught to make judgment about everything you see, hear, and feel. Because when you're a child, the adults around you, you just overhear their conversation going, oh, look at that woman next door. What an idiot. You know, they're making those judgments all the time about everything. You know, oh, that TV show's rubbish, or that one's brilliant. Well, you're just exposed to judgment all the time. And you're also exposed to a sort of, depend on how your family were, but most families, you know, if you do this, you're a really good girl, and if you don't, you're really naughty. So there's this punishment reward psychology, you know, it's all part of this dualistic thinking system that we're literally conditioned in from the moment we're born. Now, the antidote of judgment, if you think about it as a linear scale, is curiosity, because you can't be judging anything when you're curious about it. If you've got beginner's mind, as the Buddhists call it, and you're looking at something as if you've never ever seen anything like that before, you're curious about what you're seeing. You're not judging it, you're just fascinated by it.
Mm.
So for me, curiosity is a practice. It's a way of being. It's a way of showing up. It's not just something you do occasionally when you're researching or something like this, you know, which is often the connotation. So this is fundamentally important. This one is to find and stay on the path that you're meant to be living on, because you have to be so curious about everything that comes up inside you and outside of you using your sensory data. Does that make sense? I hope I explained that clearly.
Yeah. Yes. It's yeah. Lovely. I do love the idea, and we've talked about it in other podcasts, but I keep coming across this idea that there are lines, and on one end is this, and on one end is this. And I love the idea that judgment and curiosity is another one of those continuous lines, right?
I think so, yeah.
So I really like that as a visual and a way to think about it, like, how do I be less judgmental? I get more.
Yeah. I mean, you probably coach people like I do. And how often do you hear a coachee say, I should be less judgmental? And I suggest that they drop that and instead say, I should be more curious. For a start, it's easier to do. It's easier to remember to be more curious.
Saying I should be less judgmental is in itself a judgment.
Yeah, right. And exactly. And our brains, the way our neurology is wired, our brains can't process a not do instruction.
Yes.
If you tell yourself not to do something, your brain can't process that.
Yeah, yeah.
Just carry on doing more of it.
Yeah. So, that's the whole white elephant, right? Don't think of an elephant.
Yeah, right. So that's why it's really important to shift to a sort of more curious place, because if you're constantly curious, if you imagine you went after this call today, you just stayed in that curious beginner's mind mode until you went to bed tonight, and you wouldn't judge anything that you saw. Mm-hmm. You know, if you consciously held your opinion back about it.
I love it. I want to ask Jenny, how does that feel like if you put yourself into that? I know how it makes me feel, and happy to share.
But... It makes me feel very safe to be in that curious space. I guess the challenge is to work out a way to get better with that practice, because so often we fall into the trap of self-doubt, anxiety, and that's the time when the mind tends to clamp down on itself again, and all that beautiful curiosity gets locked away for future use. So yeah, I'm curious as to, other than just putting in the practice, just trying to do something on a daily basis, is that how you cultivate greater curiosity and to catch yourself when you do find yourself being more judgmental? Because hey, I have to confess, I do love rushing to judgment sometimes, because that's the way my brain is wired.
Yeah, yeah. My editors, bless them, I had such two great editors when I wrote the book, and they encouraged me to look back at the entire journey and say what I'd learned from it. So the last chapter of the book is looking back. I hated being asked to do it, but they said, could you write your rules for happiness? You know, like, because all authors are supposed to have these like amazing things that they could teach everyone. I didn't think I knew anything more than anybody else, but I came up with these six rules for happiness in the book. And one of them is become your own observer, because that's the secret, really. If there is one, that's the superpower. You've got to be able to, when you decide, in the moments you decide you want to, you've got to be able to separate from your conditioned self, your personality. You've got to be able to separate from that and observe yourself with a little bit of distance and go, rather than saying, God, I'm angry about that person who's just driven across me, and be in the anger, you've got to go, oh, I notice I'm feeling anger at that person, what they've done. Because even just seeing it like that is already you're separating from it. And then you could even go a couple of steps further, saying, I'm aware I'm noticing I'm feeling anger. You know, you can even keep going further away. And that's a practice. That's a mental practice, because you have to alter your neurology to constantly repeat that.
Mm-hmm. Is there, I'm curious, is there a point, or have you found, as someone who is kind of studying this myself at the moment, and I think my practice is getting better, which is wonderful.
Well, the beautiful thing the Buddhists say is with practice is there is no better. There's nowhere to get to with it.
It's that's just you're just practicing. Yeah,
that's
right?
What's just amazing, because even the most mindful people, you know, fall off the wagon. I mean, there are some days when I'm totally unmindful, you know, and I will completely react like I'm like I've never heard anything of what I've said in the last 20 minutes.
You know, I love that. That's being humility human. And that's understanding. Exactly,
that's the nature of it. You know, it comes and it goes. It's you remember and you forget and you work with it. And that's part of it too. Self-compassion.
Yeah.
You know, that's a very, self-acceptance is a very big part of this journey, I think.
Yeah. It's that like jumping off the cliff of judgment. And then when you were talking about that, I was like, I often jump off the cliff of judgment, but I am much more easily able to kind of create a nice soft landing after I've jumped off the cliff of curiosity and loving compassion. But I still jump off that cliff.
Oh dear. I mean, there are moments when I know I'm grumpy with someone. And I know before I'm even doing it, I'm going to be not at my best self, but I can't stop myself sometimes.
Yeah, but it's the awareness, right? That's the first step, I
guess. Exactly.
So something you said in your introduction, and then one of the I guess kind of things that has come out is you said how you showed up as a man, and then one of the comments that you sent to talk about is around emotional vulnerability and genuine connection with others.
Yeah.
And I'd like to ask, do those two things come together for you? Are they separate? Is it like, how have those two things shaped you in the last 14 or
hugely. I mean, I don't know. I'll answer from a personal standpoint and just share a bit of the story, because clearly, you know, my wife leaving signaled that I wasn't showing up that brilliantly in our relationship, obviously. And I felt I owed it to myself to really take ownership for that and explore what was going on in me that had been a causal factor in that scenario. And then I went on that journey in the book, and I started traveling with a woman called Annie, and I noticed that in our relationship I was behaving in the same way sometimes. And so for a start, that really made it clear to me it was nothing to do with my ex-wife. You know, I couldn't play the blame card at all, because I noticed the same patterns occurring, and the only common denominator was me. And at a certain point, Annie was aware of how I was, you know, struggling in trying to learn and understand this. And she was reading this book, when she finished, she gave it to me. It was called Undefended Love, this book. She gave it to me while we were in Bali. And she said, I think you should read this book. I think you get a lot from it. And I started to read it, and I was sort of, it's cringing, because it was so true. It was like reflecting myself back. And it was talking about how we've all got, you know, like men have got this armor that they put on so they don't have to, they can be invulnerable and impenetrable to any kind of inputs or criticisms or anything like this. And I just saw myself as the person they were describing in this research book. I thought, wow, that's so me. I felt ready and with a hunger to change that. I thought, I don't want to repeat this anymore for the rest of my life. You know, I want to live what time I have left, because I'm just going to interject here, because when my dad died before I went on the journey, for some weird reason, I needed to know how many days he'd lived, because he was 73 when he died, and it was 27,000 days that he'd been alive. And I thought, that doesn't sound very long. One life, 27,000 days. So I did the research in the UK. The age of mortality for UK men is 80. So an average UK man of reasonable health could expect to have 29,200 days lifespan. That's the average. And when I left England to go on my 6-month sabbatical, I had 12,500 days left of my life. And so I really didn't want to keep repeating that pattern, because I thought, I've got a decent chunk of time left where I could transform that in myself and experience a different reality that's much more joyful and much better if I can do the work. So I've got this book, Undefended Love, And I immediately contacted the two psychiatrists in America that had run it, that had written the book, and said how much I got from it. And I asked, are you doing any workshops or anything like that? Could I come on? And they said, well, only in San Francisco. And I was in Asia, so it's a long way. I thought, I can't justify however much it would cost to go from Bali to San Francisco to do a two-day workshop and then come back. I thought, well, maybe because my brother worked at British Airways as a pilot. So I called him and said, can you get me a staff hotline ticket, you know, to San Francisco from London? How much would it be on these dates if you were to do it? And he came back to me and he said, you're not going to believe this. I said, well, he said, I can get you a ticket for £60 each way from London.
And I
knew that was my confirmation signal.
That's the one.
To be at that workshop.
I love it.
And so that was another confirmation signal story. So I went and I did that workshop and it was a mind blower, but also it opened up a can of worms for me that I couldn't resolve in 2 days. And so I said,
you couldn't sort that out in 2 days, right?
Yeah, right. And so I said to the two women at the end, you know, like, all these people here are all local to you. They're all going to have your support. So I'm going back to Thailand. You know, I can't, how do I support myself in the journey? They said, let's think about that. We'll come back to you. And a couple of days later, they said, we think the best way you can support yourself ongoing is to do something called the Hoffman process. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard of that because two people I'd met in my life in the 10 years before had both mentioned it because they'd done it and I'd just ignored it. But now was hearing about it again. And then I heard about it two more times in my journey. And I actually did it because it was another confirmation signal that I meant to be doing that work. And so I then did this intensive eight-day immersion to find out what was at the very root of those patterns. And I actually got to it and found out as a young child where those patterns got embedded and why and how I used it. And then I started to do the work to unravel it. And now I don't have those patterns so much. I triggered now and again, but very rare, very rare. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was
incredible. What a story of like personal awareness and growth.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wrote all of this is in the book. You know, I wrote down my experience of the Hoffman process. I even, when I was writing it, I was sending what I was writing to the Hoffman Institute saying, is it okay for me to write this in this book? You know, I'm not going to be legally sued or anything, you know, for saying any of this. And they said, no, they were thrilled to bits because they were really happy I'd so accurately and vividly described the journey.
Yeah.
For them, because it's their thing, you know, and they want to help people around the world. And they even sent a couple of people to the book launch in London to be there. It was fabulous. So they were very supportive of me writing about it.
Amazing.
I think that's a wonderful indication that we all need to read your book, right?
It's a lovely book. I haven't finished it, not because I don't like it. I'm actually taking it on a very long plane trip tomorrow so I can finish it. But I can say it catches you, the story, like your voice and the stories and the sometimes business books about people who have done businesses can be a little dry, you know. I can already say that it's not like that at all. It's like talking to you, right? It's like hearing you speak and
thanks, Sarah.
You know, quirky stories and I love it. So I'm looking forward to finishing it.
I'm so happy to hear that because I think a few people write these books going, I was really, you know, messed up and I went and did this and now I'm sorted and I never
now
have to feel anything ever
better.
Again, you know. And I really didn't want to be one of those guys, you know, I mean, because I'm sort of far from perfect, even though I've done lots of work to be the man I believe I can and want to be in the world, you know, sort of show up the best I can. Still got work to do and I will be doing it for the rest of my life. So, but I just wanted to offer what I've learned so far on the journey I've been on to others to see if it might be useful for them.
Oh, it's lovely. You know, as a woman in work and a woman who's worked in kind of some male dominated areas, which are, you know, with some fabulous and amazing male leaders, but it's having those allies and people who maybe were a certain way and have made a change and talk about it openly and share that for me it's such a gift and such beautiful stories to hear and people to work with and things to listen to. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think it's absolutely beautiful.
And if any of your listeners want to, if they read the book and they want to have a virtual coffee with me, I'm really happy to do that. You know, if they want
amazing.
To ask any detail or ask any questions or get some insight as to how they could, like you were saying, start shifting their thinking. I'd be really happy to have a conversation with anyone. I love talking to people who've read the book and are on that path. You see, I just love it.
Amazing. Well, we will, in the show notes, we'll have all of your links. We'll have the link to the book. It's called Life Without a Tie. You can get it on most online bookshops. I really recommend it. So if we were to wrap up, obviously you have your six points, but what would be three things that if someone is just catching the last snippet of this conversation, what are three things that you would like to leave them with, Ray?
Three things. Well, self-awareness is key to everything. You know, that's the place to start, is to get as much awareness and understanding of oneself as possible. And that never stops at work. So that's a kind of, that's a way of life. It's not a one-time thing. Mm-hmm. So that would be one, number one, you know, choose to have a mindset that's sort of built around self-awareness and keep improving it and stay with that. You already, that's already going to provide a lot of remarkableness in your life. Two is, once you're in that place of self-awareness, you may find that your inner voice is a lot louder and speaking to you more often, etc. And my encouragement would be to always listen very, very carefully to that guidance, and wherever it's feasible, you know, follow that, because that's magical as a way of life. And then the third one is, know that there's a bigger plan in place than any of us can fathom, and the universe has always got your back. And whenever you need, when you really need it, it generally always shows up. I mean, that's my experience of this, my whole life, not just this journey, but even before, you know, the things that we really need to evolve and be our best selves always generally show up, even at the last moment sometimes, but they do. So faith and trust in the process.
Fantastic. Well, Ray, thank you so much for your generosity and sharing all your wisdom with us. I think we have both gleaned so much from hearing your story, and I know our listeners will take so much away from this conversation as well. So thank you
Brilliant.
You so much. And
you're welcome.
We look forward to staying in touch with you as well.
Thanks a lot. I look forward to seeing this when it's out.
Can't wait. Thank you so much, Ray. If anyone wants to reach you, I think, you know, LinkedIn is a great place to find you. Is that the best way for them to get you?
It is. And lifewithoutatie.com. The book has its own website. So
amazing. I'm glad to see you didn't like go off brand and come up with a tie today.
That's true.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks everybody for listening. We'd love to know, what did you take away from this conversation? What will you do differently? How will you employ that curiosity or self-compassion or vulnerability? Are you going to jump off a cliff? Are you going to go traveling for 14 years? How will you take this fabulous inspiration from Ray and live your best life?
Thanks so much for tuning in to this episode of Thriving with Sarah and Jenny. We hope you've enjoyed listening to it as much as we did recording it.
And you can always get involved in the well-being conversation at all of our social links in the show notes. Until next time, stay safe, stay happy, and thrive in whatever you do.